besides the pilot knowing that the elevator, rudder, and ailerons all seem to be almost inoperative, should have given him, with enough experience, a lot of feedback saying that I can't believe that all these controls are becoming inoperative simultaneously. I must have much too little airflow over those surfaces. I must be either stalling or nearly stalling. He had other clues if he was experienced enough that he should have recognized. That's a guess on my part. Over to you, Hank. K2IW. Wait for the beeps.
Charlie X-ray.
Yeah, I heard Charlie X-ray, and I'm sure Dick will recognize you. But the real issue, Dick, is that at some point, the number of alarms that are going off are more of a distraction than a help. And if you misprioritize which set of problems you're going to diagnose before you get to whatever it is that caused the problem, you can end up going down any number of rabbit holes, if you will, any number of things or procedures that will distract you from finding the root cause. And I've seen that scenario in a simulator down in Miami years ago when the NTSB findings first came out, and they were very aware that pilots might fall into this problem. And basically what they found was that it was just very difficult to prioritize correctly which set of problems you were going to address first, and that's really what killed them, is they didn't go first to fly the airplane. That's the simple basic thing. You've got to fly the plane before you can play with all the or solve all the problems that the computers are complaining about. N1YDY.
Yeah, I think the priorities are aerate, navigate, communicate, or something like that. Go ahead, Steve. Wait for the beeps.
Oh, I didn't get the musical triple tone. That's okay. Anyhow. Yeah, that airspeed indicator issue, and one of the things are, if you get, you end up with getting the pitot tube clogged. The static source on the side of the aircraft, and an aircraft that's climbing, continues to drop in pressure with the drop in barometric pressure outside. And that change in pressure with the clogged steady pressure, that's the false pressure in the pitot tube, makes the aircraft's speed go up and up and up. When you become a fixed, it continues to go up with no change in nose out. It gets pretty easy to become hooked on that and not start cross-checking other things. It's impossible to occur, and people get hung up on that stuff. But as all pilots are told, you're flying the airplane, but when your nose is pitched up and you're watching this gauge going up, and you're concerned about your job and hurting the airplane, a lot of things happen. But we got off the old cooling effect, and you know, I don't know if we really understood it. The hot water being cooled with the molecules further apart because they're hotter becomes an easier situation as the whole thing cools down. And you got to look at those graphs. Some of them they wrote them up, but there's, you know, a lot of plausible work that has been done to explain. Yes, super cooling, superheating of water. I'm sure everybody's experienced that with their microwave oven. I'm going to keep listening here because I did have my fingers bobbing up and down. Good to hear you guys talking about all sorts of nifty stuff. K2C.
Yeah, beyond 11 o'clock, we only get one beep. So, Roy, I think there is still some mystery about hot water freezing faster. Lots of possible explanations. I don't think you and I are aware of a well-documented article on the subject representing an experiment where all of the parameters, so to speak, are traceable to the Bureau, and therefore there's a nice, concise answer. I think there's still a fair amount of controversy among smart people on this subject. That's my guess. AC2GS, K2LIW.
AC2GS, you are quite right, Dick. But that's why I kind of presented it to the group rather than just 1 + 1 = 2. Here's one of the great mysteries of life. Ponder it as you wish.
Roy, from your point of view, would this be a convenient time to go over to the space report? Because this is around the time that we normally let Paul do his thing. AC2GS for a comment? And if so, you pass it to Paul, K2RIW in the tech net, if you think it's appropriate.
Yes, I think it's quite appropriate. I will put in a short little plug, again, for the mailbag. mailbag@limarktech.net. mailbag@limarktech.net. And hopefully next week we will talk about the black holes, which are very interesting things. And the website to look for that is whole.limark.tech. Just like the TechNet is T-E-C-H, that's what it ends in, T-E-C-H. Whole.limark.tech is the article that we're going to be kind of discussing. And it's my pleasure to hand it over to Paul with the space report.
Very good, Roy. This is WS2N. And yes, we have the 280th space report. SpaceX is, I talk about that from week to week, and they have now got Launch Complex 40 now operating again. A little over a year ago, Launch Complex 40, it was going to launch a satellite for Israel from that complex, and what happened is the whole thing blew up. I mean, the second stage just lit up, and that was it. Took out the $150 million satellite, took out the rocket itself, and the launch complex. So they rebuilt the launch complex. By the way, they looked into that, talking about cryogenics and freezing. It was a sudden freezing of oxygen between the wrappings going around a helium tank, which was inside the second stage, that crushed the tank. Aluminum type of tank, and they believe it in doing that it created a spark, and the whole thing just blew up. And since that time, they've corrected all of that problem. They've launched about 20 rockets since. I'm dropping.
Paul, there's a little bit of hiss on your signal. Is there a way you can do an experiment where you aim your azimuth first a couple of degrees to the right and tell me what you're doing, and a couple of degrees to the left, and I'll tell you which one gives you less hiss? Go ahead.
Okay, it might be easier this way. Is there a hiss on this signal?
Sounds like you turned on a second transmitter, and there's essentially no hiss on that one, though, Paul. Will that transmitter be able to take a long transmission without overheating?
I just went into the east and repeated, that's all. I thought maybe it was a fan. I have a fan on the radio itself, but apparently not above dead bull quieting now.
Well, the hiss is less. I think on the 8-5 repeater, you're able to get there when you aim your antenna correctly. The trouble is that when you aim it for best signal on reception, it's not necessarily the best aiming for transmission. Back to you, Paul.
Okay, I haven't moved it since last week. Usually I move it to Connecticut. Yeah, I'm going now a couple of degrees. How's that thing?
What direction did you move? And nothing changed on that one. Paul, go ahead.
I think I was a little too far west, so now I came up a little bit. Coming up a little further. Just might be positions. I think that's probably too far. This is WS2N.
Yes, that is too far. You went through the sweet spot.
Okay, turning the rotator back. I think that's about the best I'm going to do. I could always go over to Zeldin and just crank up the power.
What you've got right now is quite good. Please proceed.
Really? Okay. So it is a little further off the off west, a little further to the north. Okay. Very good. SpaceX now has rebuilt Launch Complex 40. That's where they were launching their original Falcon 9s from. And then they were developing Launch Complex 39A, and that, you remember, is the original launch complex that NASA always used for the space shuttles and before that, Saturn V moon rockets. So, they completely moved over there. They've launched 18 rockets from that that location, between that and a couple of rockets from Launch Complex 4E out in California and Vandenberg Air Force Base. So very successful, one right after the other, most rockets that they've launched ever in 1 year. Now, you know, that's for 2017. But since September of last year, September 1st, 2016, when that rocket blew up, they finally got around to rebuilding Launch Complex 40, and they made a lot of changes, put a lot of electronics and equipment and tanks and pipes and everything underneath the ground, and put concrete over it, and they basically changed all the, they have a lot of water deluge systems when the rockets light off, they increased that. They made upgrades to this complex that they didn't know that they were going to do when they first built it. Since it blew up, they took the opportunity to change everything.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Another Dragon spacecraft, the 13th of their contract with NASA, up to the International Space Station. They'll be bringing almost 5,000 pounds of stuff up. They changed out the erector set. You know, there's an erector that brings the rocket up and then backs off. That was completely destroyed. They put a new one in, an upgraded one similar to what they have in Launch Complex 39A. And they know that one performs a lot better. So they're moving along, and that's good to see. So they plan on launching a Dragon spacecraft that has launched previously. So this is like the space shuttle. They're reusing the same spacecraft that's going to dock with the space station. And they're also reusing the boosters. It's about the third or fourth, fourth booster that they're going to reuse. They save them. You know, they either come back to land or they land on the barge out in the ocean. And then they bring them back, refurbished. And this will be the first time they're sending up a reused rocket and a reused spacecraft at the same time. So that naturally really cuts the cost, and that's been SpaceX's goal all along. So they're doing quite well. Now the Cygnus spacecraft, which went up a month or two ago, has now undocked from the International Space Station. And normally what they do with these vehicles, all the cargo vehicles, they immediately send them over to the Pacific Ocean and they burn up in the atmosphere. Or in SpaceX's case with the Dragon spacecraft, they send it over to the Pacific Ocean, but they have a parachute and a heat shield, and they're able to land in the Pacific Ocean and bring back science experiments or equipment that's broken that the engineers need to get a hold of and find out what the problem is, such as an EVA suit, that type of thing. And the Cygnus spacecraft is normally would do the same thing, but they're going to leave it up there for a couple of weeks, and that's now acting as its own satellite. And it has on board nanoracks, which are filled up with 14 CubeSats that they're going to launch into orbit before they decide to de-orbit. this Cygnus spacecraft. So Cygnus is going to also do some tests. They're going to depressurize the inside of the Cygnus spacecraft and do some other tests that, they're working on. And this is what they do now. They've done this quite a few times in some of their flights. They've lit fires inside the spacecraft and tested different materials, see how they burn in microgravity. And then about 2 weeks from now, they're going to deorbit it, and it will burn up over the Pacific Ocean. And in the craft itself, there's about 6,000 pounds worth of junk and stuff they're going to throw away, everything from cotton clothes to equipment that they don't need that does not have to be returned to Earth. So, and that Cygnus is launched by an Antares rocket, and it's by Orbital ATK. They're the ones that launch those things, and that's the ones that launch out of Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia. Let me drop. This is WS2N. So a couple of other things involved with the International Space Station. You have a crew up there of six people, and three of them will be coming back down on, actually this week, they'll be coming down on the 14th, and another crew will be going up on the 17th. So you have three Americans, and one guy from Italy, and two Russians, because you need, each one is a pilot, or commander for the Soyuz spacecraft. You have two spacecraft attached to the International Space Station right now. Anytime you have six people on board, you need at least two spacecraft, because you need three seats on each one in case there's an emergency to bring them back. So each one of those Russians are pilots for their respective spacecraft. And that's going to change probably at the end of this year, hopefully. Let me drop it. By the end of this year, and definitely by next year, but most likely by the end of this year, you should at least see a spacecraft launch from American soil that will be carrying at least two astronauts up to the space station. Hopefully that will occur before December, and most likely that would be SpaceX. They have a Dragon crewed version that they've completed building, and hopefully that will be ready by the end of the year. If not a crew, they'll at least be able to, I'm sure, send up a crewed vehicle without a crew. That's the goal anyway. The first flight will be without a crew, and that will automatically dock with the space station, spend a week or so up there, and then detach and then come back. That would be the first test of a crewed vehicle. The next flight up would be with a crew if that all goes well. That being said, if they wind up behind schedule for any reason, you have Boeing. Boeing is building the Starliner, and that should be, they thought that was going to be ready by the end of the year, but that's most likely going to be ready by the beginning of 2019. So, within a year and a half or so, we should have regular flights up to the space station. And instead of a crew of three, like I said before, when the Russians go up with the Soyuz spacecraft, there's always three people that go up, three people that go down. The Dragon by SpaceX will be able to do four, and you'll be able to do four as well with Boeing, the Starliner. And hopefully that's the way it'll be going in a couple of years. They both have the capability of actually bringing up seven people. But the present plan is to bring up four at a time, four down. Let me drop it. Okay, another project that was covered here on the net quite a bit a couple of years ago was the BEAM, the Bigelow expandable activity module. That's the module that was sent up in the back of the trunk of the SpaceX Dragon spacecraft, cargo craft, a couple of years ago that docked with the space station. And then they had the robotic arm pull out this module, and it was all, you know, curled up. They attached it to the space station, actually, to the Tranquility module, and then let it sit there for a couple of months, and then finally they decided to inflate it, and it successfully inflated, and it's been like that for over a year now. So it's really passed the test, and NASA has decided to use this as a permanent module now. They took out all the test equipment, all the stuff that was on the inside of the beam, and they lined it with walls. Now it looks like, instead of when you go in, instead of looking at a sphere, now it looks like a regular room like you would see on the rest of the International Space Station. And what they're going to use it for is storage. They could always use another room for storage. And the original plan for Beam was, after 2 years, they were going to close the door and deorbit it and let it burn up over the Pacific. It's done so well, not one leak, no problems with micrometeorites or radiation, and it's passed all the tests. So they decided to keep this beam attached to the space station and use it as another room forever. So that was good to hear. They had a nice picture of the guy from Italy inside. You know, he's from the European Space Agency. They show him inside outfitting this room, getting it ready for cargo. You know, future cargo and storage. Let me drop it. So that's the story on that. A lot of things we always talk about here. I know, Dick, you always ask about the people that eventually want to go to the moon. Russia has now ordered to build a lunar lander and a lunar orbiter. They're on their way back to the moon. Hopefully, for them, probably within a couple of years, they plan on sending these two vehicles to the moon, and that's going to be one's going to be a lander, and the other one's going to be an orbiter. And the orbiter will act like a repeater and send information back to Russia. But this is their first step to doing what we talk about on the net all the time. They plan on eventually going back and staying on the moon. They would like to make a permanent lunar base there, and they plan on landing there with people around 2029, the end of the 2020s. So let me drop it.
Did they explain, Paul, how they're going to have the people survive the extremely high temperature at high noon on the moon and the extremely cold temperature at midnight on the moon? Was any of that explained to Paul? Go ahead.
No, this is preliminary stuff that I'm just reading. It just actually came out last week. That's a long way off from 2029. But it would be on the South Pole, and they have their own crater that they would like to create a base by. And we have our own crater down by Shackleton Crater that we would like to do the same thing. But at any base that's established will be probably on the South Pole, no doubt. But they have other missions planned as well. They plan on landing a lander on the far side of the moon, which hasn't been done yet. And actually, China has that plan, too. And China's well on their way. I think it's Chang 7 or something like that. They plan on actually landing on the far side of the moon. I think that if they keep going the way they're going, they'll beat the Russians at that project. Land, you know, nobody's ever really done that successfully. So we'll see what happens. Let me drop this.
The Russian lander and the Russian orbiter. Do they say what is the main purpose? Is the lander going to take a sample and return it to Earth or something like that, over you both? And also, how soon? Is Russia going to do this in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? Go ahead.
They plan on developing this thing within 2 years. So I think they could do that. And as far as sample returns, they've done that with Luna 24. That was the last one that they did back in the 1970s. They actually had a sample return mission. And they plan on duplicating that they're going to call the orbiter Luna 26, and I think Luna 27 will be the sample return mission. But you got quite a few years for the sample return mission. They think they could send the orbiter and the rover, or land, not it won't be a rover, lander by 2019. So that's the end of 2019. They think they could possibly launch this thing. So it would land on the moon probably 2020, I'm going to guess, the earliest.
And if the lander is going to return a sample, what's different about the sample now versus the previous sample? Go ahead.
That lander won't. A couple of missions after that, probably 2024, 20, something like that, you might have a sample return mission. So I didn't see any drawings or pictures on that. I have seen the drawings and pictures on this first lander and their orbiter. So I'm sure that's doable. For some reason, they would like to bring another sample back. I don't know why. You know, we've bought a total of 800 pounds of stuff back so far. The Russians, they brought some stuff back in one of their sample return missions. I don't know what they're going to gain out of that outside of, engineering know-how. You know, it's been all decades since the 1970s. They might just want to do it just to see if they can. There's no reason for that. That's kind of odd, but, you know, China wants to do the same thing. They plan on having a sample return mission as well. So, we'll see. One other thing, the wheels on the rovers riding around on Mars have been giving natural problems. There's a lot of big holes and cracks in the wheels of Opportunity. Wheels of Curiosity. So, the next rover has already been designed. The wheels are supposed to be much better. Probably won't break up that much. But there's another set of wheels they're developing for future rovers. And they know they're going to have future rovers either robotically or with people in it. You know, you might need bigger cars, you know, for people to drive around on Mars.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The metal is nickel titanium alloy. So this memory alloy is, they've made it, it looks like a regular wheel.
You timed out and I reset the machine. Of the 800 pounds of lunar soil that the Apollo missions returned to Earth, back in those days we were pretty magnanimous. Did we ever share any of that 800 pounds of lunar soil with Russia? Back to you, Paul.
As far as I know, every country, they tried to send it to every country that wanted it. They sent everybody a rocket to, you know. And, it wound up in museums. Some of it wound up stolen. There's a lot of problems with the moon stuff that came back. So, yeah, as far as Russia goes, I'm sure they got some. They had a deal with the astronauts to go around from country to country when they came back, which they really weren't crazy about. They didn't like that. And they were pretty much cut off from future missions, too. What are you going to do? Beam and who's the other guy? Let me think of him. Sexton. The third guy to land on the moon.
Buzz?
The little guy. he's the guy that said there might have been one big step for Neil Armstrong, but to me it's not. That was Apollo 12. So Conrad and Dean, they're the ones that walked on the moon. But they got to go in on Skylab. So at least they got to go on a couple of different missions before that. Anyway, let me drop it. Lost my train of thought. I've talked about the Electron rocket that's going to be going off from New Zealand. That's a rocket that's not going to be, it's an orbital rocket, but it's only going to bring up maybe 400 or 500 pounds of stuff, but it's by an independent person, by Peter Beck, and he did launch one rocket so far from there. It didn't make it to orbit, and this one was supposed to take off tonight, but it's been delayed until tomorrow, so I'll have to see how it works out. It's an expendable rocket, it's not a reusable one. It does have 9 Rutherford engines, put the payload to orbit. All these countries, all these entities, all these private people are involved with the space program, and I'd like to be here about another 20 years from now on the net and find out how many people we have in space or future spacemen. Right now we're up to 500 people that have flown into space. I'm going to guess within 20 years that we're going to double that number. Back to you, Dick. That's it for the Space Net Report. That is K2RIWWS2.
Wow. That's surprising to me. Run that by again. I know of, Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, 17. 12 people were on the moon during Apollo. And quite a number of groups of people have been on the International Space Station. And with Mercury and Gemini, quite a number of people went into near-Earth orbit. So you're saying if I add up all those people, I would have guessed 150. If I add up all those people, it's 500 astronauts have been into space. And by into space, I think you mean not only suborbital, but even, are these 500 people orbital, or does it also include suborbital? But that's not going to make much of a difference. I think we've only had a couple of people that went suborbital into space. Back to you, Paul. 500. Who announced that number? You got it, Paul. K2RIW.
Yeah, that's what it is. I've read that many times over the last couple of years. They were up to 450, 480, and I think they're around 500, give or take a few. Don't know the exact number. It changes quite rapidly. every 4 months you have another 3 people going up, another 3 people coming back. That's on that's since 2011. 2011 was the end of the space shuttle. But yeah, you're right around 500. And you look at suborbital flights, that doesn't count. You only had 2. We've had Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom. They went on two 15-minute flights on the Redstone rocket, then they went to the Atlas rocket with John Glenn. So out of Mercury, you had, you know, six flights. Well, the original seven, only six went up. Deke's flight didn't make it. Then you had the Gemini program, and you started with two at a time. You had 10 missions, so 20 flights. Some people were repeats on those flights.
Now, let me ask you another related question. 500, are these astronauts plus Soviet cosmonauts plus the Chinese Chinanauts? Does the 500 include United States, Soviet Union, and China? And I think those are the only three countries that have put human beings into space. Over you, Paul.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, we've naturally put people from all over the world into space with our space system, and so have the Russians. And China, well, they just put their own people up. Collectively, China's got, what, five flights? So they've got about, you know, eight people. Some of the flights are two people, some of the flights are three people. And they're takanauts. We got astronauts, they have takanauts, and then the cosmonauts. And the cosmonauts have done quite a few, of course, over the decades. Yeah, collectively, worldwide. And then you got the space shuttle system. You got 135 flights, averaging 4 to 7 people on those flights. Russia has always been sending up two, and then they started with three. You know, ever since the Mir missions, it was always three at a time. Sometimes they would send two, and it just kept adding up. And now you have 12 a year since 2011. So that's quite a few there. And that's what it comes out to, you know, men, women, all the different countries, probably about 20 different countries. Even Saudi Arabia, we sent a guy up from Saudi Arabia one time. Back to WS2S.
What's the total number of females that have been put into orbit? Is there a number for that, Paul?
It's about 10%. It's about 40. I think just over 40 now.
Okay, the very first female was Russian, but of those 40, I'm going to guess the majority are Americans.
Actually, Russia has only had two people actually from Russia. They've sent other women up in their spacecraft from different countries, you know, South Korea and places, but there's only been actually two women from Russia, would you believe it? And the first one was Valentina Tereshchukova, and that was the first one. And then they had another one, a few years ago, went up to the International Space Station. They made a big thing out of that because, you know, they haven't had one since Valentina. So, we've had most of them from the United States. There's been one from South Korea. One from Japan, and the rest from here. One of them was eventually became in charge of NOAA. She just left this year. She was the one that did the first woman spacewalk, Catherine Sullivan, back then.
Let's see if we have anyone on frequency that have any further questions for Paul. I think I mentioned the fact that the square kilometer radio telescope is under construction right now in Western Australia. That's a biggie. That's the biggest radio telescope. When it's finished, it'll be the biggest radio telescope in the world. and it's a whole lot of individual elements on flat ground, all fed as a huge phased array, thousands of individual antenna elements all being combined. So it's got electronic steering and lots of computer processing. So in theory, depending on how they set up the computer processing, that phased array antenna, if it's got individual recorders on each individual element, the phased array antenna can do its processing where it's looking in multiple directions simultaneously, with each direction it's looking in having the maximum gain of all of those elements. Ain't that crazy? You can be putting up 15 pencil beams in space. A pencil beam is the smallest possible beam that you can make out of that array, and you could put 15 of them in space simultaneously in the receiving mode. Look at 15 stars at once. Ain't that something, Paul? The article doesn't say that. I just know what a phased array is capable of doing if they're willing to install enough computer hardware. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, that was the one that they were supposed to be linked with South Africa. And one of them was going to run dish antennas, like, I don't know, 30 feet diameter antennas or something. The other one was going to be, was it Australia that was going to have all these dipoles, like a million dipoles? And I'm not kidding. That's what I remember reading. I don't know if they still plan on doing that. It's going to take over. Instead of 1 square kilometer, it's going to be like hundreds of kilometers. It's not just one, you know, they went by the original name. I know that. And that's been changed out, I guess, 5 years ago. And when is this thing supposed to come online? And, I think I remember hearing $500 million project or something. But that was quite a few years ago. I forgot all about that square kilometer array back in there.
Yeah, the December issue of IEEE Spectrum Magazine has 8 pages on the subject. It's online right now, Paul, but not with full capability. In other words, as they install more and more of these very elaborate-looking dipole-like antennas and more of these dishes, the dishes are used on the high frequency. This thing works from HF frequencies all the way up to millimeter wave frequencies. So it's on the air right now, but not with full capability. They're going to continuously be adding more elements. That's going to get bigger and bigger, higher and higher in gain, higher and higher in selectivity. And the full completed array, I think they said something like 2028 or 2029. Paul, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, we'll have to wait to see what that's going to look like. I don't know. I really haven't looked at too many pictures from radio. Yeah, the ones I've seen are never as impressive, let me put it this way, never as impressive as optical or infrared. But I guess the scientists like to see it. You know, it's always kind of, like, not as detailed. But I guess this thing's going to be detailed with all those antennas. You know, here's what they could do. They could set up an array on Earth, go to the moon, set up a base on the moon, somehow connect the antennas using interferometry. Do you think that would be possible there? And now you're going to have instead of a baseline of, you know, a couple hundred miles with a square array, now you could have a baseline of, you know, a quarter of a million miles.
Is that doable? Absolutely. When you're doing very long baseline interferometry now, you might have one radio telescope in Hawaii, one in South America, a couple of them in North America, a couple of them in Africa, a couple of them in Europe, a couple of them in Australia, and they're all looking at the same star system at the same time. At each one of those locations, you're doing a very high resolution data recording. Nowadays, it's all done on hard drives. and you take all those hard drives from all those locations with very accurate timing marks on them, and you ship them to all one common place. It might be Socorro, New Mexico, or it might be Cambridge, Massachusetts. You put them in one place, and then you combine them with a real good computing system. So if you can ship hard drives, as opposed to running a great big long cable between Hawaii and the United States, you can ship hard drives. That gives you the equivalent of having a cable, just that it's delayed processing. If you can ship hard drives, you could have part of your very long baseline interferometer on the moon and mail the beta data back by satellite, if you know what I mean. Now, let me drop.
Yeah, Connie.
I heard somebody say something. I'll pick up with you in a minute. The reason why optical astronomy gives you such more exciting pictures is because of the resolution. Whether it be an optical telescope or a radio telescope, it's the exact same physics. Every time you've got roughly 70 wavelengths of width of the receiving antenna, you've got 1 degree of beam width. Very rough rule of thumb. 70 wavelengths is 1 degree. If you had 140 wavelengths, you'd have half a degree and so on. Well, you work out the mathematics of that. The
repeater, timeout.
You work out the mathematics of that. Your huge optical telescopes have thousands of, and maybe millions, of wavelengths of diameter. So you get down to radians, milliradians, microradians of azimuth and elevation resolution. So you're getting real fine details with optical. With radio telescopes, you didn't have anywhere near, because the frequency is so much lower, therefore the wavelengths are so much bigger, you didn't have anywhere near that resolution. But when you start building something like a square kilometer, or maybe someday it's going to be a square 10 kilometers, if you've got a flat enough piece of land, like they do in Western Australia, and you build the array wide enough, even though you're on a low frequency, you'll eventually get that resolution back, and then with the right kind of computer processing, you'll get all those pretty pictures. So it's just a matter of building it bigger, as I see it, Paul. WS2N, K2IW. I pick up the person who wants to say something.
Yeah, Roger. This is KT2, calling Yankee Whiskey. Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you, Paul, for the space report. And I guess I'm going to be 72 for now. And thank you, guys. Pass it back to Dick.
Hey, Joe, are you checking out? You didn't ask us for permission to check out. I'm having some fun with him. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, it's getting late. I got to wake up 5 in the morning. Yeah, I'm checking out now. And thank you, guys. And I wanted to say thank you, Paul, for the space report and keep us updated. And hopefully next week you'll come on earlier. Because I remember you used to come on like around 9:30 or 10 o'clock.
Okay, maybe one of these weeks we'll reverse Paul and Roy. There's another person who wants to ask us something. Go right ahead.
73, Joe.
Was there another person who wants to ask us a question?
WB2BX.
Hey, Frank, we're now hearing you. I think I may have timed out the machine by talking too long last time, which I think interrupted your astrolink. You know what I mean. The way of linking computers. So go right ahead with your question, Frank. WB2BXO, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, I saw on Twitter from NASA a couple of weeks ago that they had detected a planet or perhaps another exoplanet at about 11 light years distance that apparently they feel may have the right characteristics to support life. What I was wondering about is, at that range, would it be possible to detect RF signals created by a civilization there, or would the only way to detect at that range if there was something being transmitted using lasers or neutrinos, something capable of creating a coherent pencil beam, that RF can't do. Go ahead, please.
Frank, I should tell you that your audio is 10 decibels lower than everybody else. Your audio is very low. I'm hearing you because I'm wearing earphones. Very, very low audio. But 11 light years, I think it is, this other exoplanet nearby us, which looks like it has the right conditions. Could we detect radio signals at that distance? Absolutely. Now, are they transmitting a strong enough radio signal at the frequencies where we are listening, is an interesting question. Also, our equipment is continuously increasing. Let me drop. Our radio receiving equipment, like this square kilometer array in Western Australia, and a portion of it's also going to be in Africa, as a long baseline interferometer, that's getting more sensitive, higher in resolution. The optical telescopes, they're building bigger and bigger ones, so they're getting better. And by way of the James Webb Space Telescope, it's going to be going up in the next year and a half or so, it can look at the edge of a planet as it waves in front of their sun, and by using spectroscopy techniques, you possibly can detect things like methane. If you detect methane in the atmosphere, you know that living organisms are probably down there. So as I see it, with James Webb going up, with a square kilometer coming online, with bigger optical telescopes being constructed, it's just a matter of time before we were able to detect the presence of life by various techniques, assuming it's there. That's the way I see it. Do whatever you can to give us more volume. Shout into that mic, turn up the volume to the Echo Link or whatever. WB2BXO, T2RIW. You got it, Frank.
Okay, trying to play with the volume control here. That may have to wait till next time. Anyway, very interesting. I guess we're going to have to see what happens. I know the space rocket was detected running through the solar system. It's pretty much been established that was a natural object. Anyway, I'm not going to frustrate you anymore. I may be able to adjust the volume and come back before you close the net. But you need to be extra.
Yeah, I can tell you were shouting into the mic, and that helped somewhat. You came up a dB or two, but you got 8 more dB to go, as I see it, Frank. So, quite a bit of what I just said in that last transmission, Paul, was my speculations, but you're keeping your ear closer to the ground on these subjects. So when it comes to detecting life on these exoplanets, as I see it, our capability is continuously increasing. I'm convinced it's just a matter of time before we confirm it. WS2N, K2RIW, you've got a poll.
K2CX.
Let's pick up Steve first. Go ahead, Steve, and then you pass it over to Paul.
Yeah, Frank, with the low audio, are you running an ICOM radio? Is it Frank, is his name?
His name is Frank, but he's now digging into the subroutines of either Echo Link or his radio to try to increase the volume. That's probably why he's not coming back to us. You've got a poll.
Yeah, just make sure you have number one filter. The number one filter on, not number two. You'll have half the deviation. K2C.
Yeah, he's usually a lot louder. Let me see if I have it. Okay, well, yeah, everybody forgets about the time factor. You know, will the civilization be there at the same time I was? You know, we've been here for 4 billion years, this planet, and it's only a tick of a clock as far as time goes that we've been able to transmit signals off our planet. Or receive signals. So, you know, we have to find somebody else that's doing that. And, you know, yeah, there's a possibility that they've been around for millions of years and maybe there's millions of years, you know, into the future, you know, for them since they've been transmitting and so they're able to continue to do that. But say they're not there yet, you know. I guess there's always that possibility too, you know. Maybe a million years from now they're going to start transmitting. So, well, that'll be too late for us. I think that's a big factor. I think I want to ask about this array that they're building in Australia and South Africa. Let's say it was a 1 kilometer array, you know, perfect kilometer. Let me drop it. Would the inverse square law apply with that as well? In other words, if you wanted to double the signal, double it, whatever they're listening to was 1 kilometer, if they wanted to double it, are they going to have to make this thing 4 kilometers to double the signal and so on, 9 for triple? Back to you there.
If it's the sensitivity you're doubling, Paul, you'll only have to double the area to double the sensitivity. So if your horizontal dimension and your vertical dimension increased by the square root of 2, 1.414, 41% increase in width and 41% increase in height doubles the area, that doubles the sensitivity. If you want to double the horizontal beam, if you want to half the horizontal beam width, you have to double the width. If you want to half the vertical beam width, you have to double the height. So beam width works linearly with that one dimension, and sensitivity goes up as the area. And by the way, this new exoplanet, let me drop it. This new exoplanet that Frank is asking about, I think he said it was 11 light years away. So that means the signal only takes 11 years to get to us. That's at the distance where you could almost have a two-way conversation, as I see it, Paul. And we're going to time out in roughly 1 minute. So I'm going to put on my final touches. 1,680 was the number of this TechNet. 280 was the number of Paul's space report. I'm going to pass it over to Roy, if he's still with us, to say some final words, AC2GS, and he's going to pass it over to Paul. Bye-bye, you all. Try to be kind to each other. And keep thinking science. AC2GS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
AC2GS, and I'm almost always here. Just a reminder, mailbag@limarktech.net, and the website about the black hole that we'll discuss next week is whole.limark.tech. And over to you, Paul. And by the way, always a pleasure. Enjoyed it immensely and looking forward to next week. So over to you, Paul.
Okay, very good. And yeah, we'll be here next week. And yeah, we're getting close to the holidays, but next week will be good. And that website that you talked about with the black hole, I did go to that when you sent that to me. I read more about that. That should be good. See, we'll be back next week. I'm looking at the time. Time's out. 73, guys. Have a good week. This is WS2N. Clear.
Yeah, one thing I'm going to tell you, Roy, during the one time that the... Stony Brook Open Night Astronomy classes were given on the first Friday of the month.
on the one time when they did discuss black holes, their biggest lecture hall, which holds 300 people in seats, was standing room only. That occurred about 3 years ago.